things on the outside starts to get smaller. It is when this reality on the inside is small that things on the outside has to be big. All right? That's why you're pushing. You want this, you want more of this, you want more of that, you want more of this, you want more of that. Everything out there is always having this temptation or this lust to be bigger, larger. I want more of this. It's not enough. I want it louder. I want it bigger. I want it taller. I want it, you know, humongous. I want it to be more, whatever. You know, we start to push the limits out there. So I always say that watch sometimes the emphasis that we put on outside things. And I always have this caution for people. I say that when things on the outside starts to be, or we start to put so much of the emphasis on the outside, it could very well be a sign that something on the inside is getting to get, is starting to show it's small. Or if not, it's getting smaller. All right? So it's when this whole increase of the life of Jesus in us begins to take place on the inside. And that's why Jesus is wanting to grow. Everything about our spiritual life is to grow. The Jesus in us wants to grow. And as the growth of Jesus becomes more real, all right, and larger and bigger and higher and more extensive, and this is when you begin to understand that you need so little on the outside. So I suppose this is what happens. So I'm thankful that as I watch the growth, as I watch and pay attention on the life on the inside of me, I'm beginning to discover more and more that I don't have to live on the outside, to depend on these outward stimulants, you know. And I need to have all of this to get me to worship, or get me to sing, or get me to serve, or get me, you know, to go to church, or to get me to do this and do the other. You see how much we have to depend on the outside things in order to get us moving. All right. And so my question is, what is inside us that gets us moving, that stimulate us, that motivate us, that lift us up without any external stimulant? No drums, no guitar, no keyboards, you know, no one coming to all the time having to keep pushing you. Get up to pray, or get up to worship, or get to church, or this or then the other. You know, so much of those on the outside. Now, don't wrong me. We need encouragement once in a while. We need people to come by to give us a push, to give us a lift. Sometimes they even give you a kick. All right? And I'm not physically, what I meant is, you know, someone to give you a strong word, someone to give you a gentle rebuke, or sometimes even a stronger rebuke, just to get you going. And we need that. But there come a time where the life of Jesus in you begins to become predominant, if you understand that word. It become predominant. It become the occupying reality. The center, you know. Jesus is not just something around the corner, you know, or all over different areas of your life. Jesus is at the center of your heart. He's the ruling center. Is the governmental center of your life. And when that happens, and the joy and the privilege and the fruit is to watch how little you need on the outside, all right, or that you need to depend on to get going in your spiritual life. All right, so I want you to know that every time when I'm looking forward to come on the Tuesday, I'm looking forward to see all your faces. Looking forward to share, to even hear. And so I'm thankful for the last two Tuesdays I've been relaxed, busy with my book, and hearing these brothers to share their hearts and to minister to us. And I have been benefited from their sharing. Now, what I want to do is that what I share with you here tonight may perhaps get us into a series. We'll see how far we can go in the coming week, something which that I seems to be feeling in my heart. Sometimes it's hard because your whole mind is on the book, and your thoughts is everywhere. My wife comes and asks me, "What do you want for lunch?" I'm thinking about dinner. I can't even tell what is lunch, what is dinner, what is breakfast anymore. I'm all over the place mentally. And so I seem to have this heart every time when I think of all of your faces. I'm having in my heart something that I want to do with you. And that's wonderful, isn't it? It's wonderful to know that in the midst of so much that you are doing or you are busy with, and yet the Lord would put in your heart faces like all of you here. You know, Joe and Z and Sky and Zach and Thomas and all of you here. The faces on before me. And I feel as if that though I don't see you on a daily basis, it's like I'm looking forward to minister to you, to share with you, to impart into your heart, into your life. And that's a wonderful thing. I'm just sharing my thoughts with you. And just because we're meeting on a Tuesday night, that doesn't mean that, you know, I don't think about you. I do. All right? And that's why when Thomas walked in, I said, "How are you doing?" Because I know he was not well. It's because I think about you. And when I think about your faces and your life, I think about having to minister to you. That's all. I'm not thinking about having, you know, anything with you. I'm not thinking about having a basketball game with you or go picnic with you or teh tarik with you. They're all nice. But I'm thinking about what I want to share with you, what I want to minister to you. And because that's who I am, I'm a minister. I'm a servant of the Lord, and I'm here to give, I'm here to impart. So I can't stop myself. Every time when I think about my family, my two sons, my daughter-in-law, and my wife, I want to think about when we sit down together, what can I say to them, minister to them, share with them what's in my heart. And now, what I want to do tonight, if the Lord is going to lead us, if He's taking my heart where it's supposed to go, I want to kind of, in a general way, okay? And well, it started off when Eugene was sharing, just about 2 weeks ago, some of you who may remember, he talked about how our faith has got roots. And the roots of our faith is Hebraic in nature. Hebraic means Jewish. Now, there's a difference between Jewish and Hebraic. Hebraic means Hebrew, all right? There's a difference between Hebrew and Jewish. Being Jewish simply means that it is a race, all right? So we hear of Jewish race, or being a Jew, or in a geographical location, we call them Semites, S-E-M-I-T-E, all right? They come from a whole region called the Semites. So the Arabs that you find, the Middle Eastern Arabs, the Bahrainians, the Jordanians, the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Iranians, they are all called Semites in those early days. So Jews were part of the whole contingent of Semites, so we call them Semites. And of course you hear of the word anti-Semite or anti-Semitism, which is anti-Jewish, anti-Israelis, and things like that, all right? So Jew is the word that we use for the race. They are Jewish. So Paul is Jewish. Peter is Jewish. All the apostles in your Bible and my Bible is Jewish. Jesus is Jewish. And why is it that God chose the Jew? I don't know. When God chooses, God chooses. And God chose the Jews. Of all of the Semites in the whole territorial, He didn't choose the Arabs, He didn't choose the Iraqis or the Jordanians or the Bahrainians or the Egyptians. They're part of the Semite group too. But He chose the Jews. So they became a race, as we call them today. They are Jewish. They live in a place called Israel, which is, of course, the state. All right? I don't call Israel a nation yet. It's a state. In 1948, when they gave the independence, or when they gave Israel this whole country again, they call it the State of Israel. So it's strange that I wonder how many Jews understand that they didn't even call Israel as a nation. They call Israel as a state, the state of Israel. And little do they know that according to the scriptures, this is exactly what happened. Just because you are a state don't mean you are a nation. Because as far as God is concerned, Israel is not a nation yet. Because when God called Israel, God has always desired that Israel will be a nation of priests. And so it's very strange that even the United Nations will call Israel as a state of Israel. To this day, they acknowledge that it's just a state of Israel. Of course, the Jews today who live in Palestine, who live where they are now, they call themselves as a nation. But as far as the United Nations is concerned, they recognize them as just as a state. And there's so many of the nations in United Nations sitting there who do not recognize Israel even as a people, let alone even a nation, or perhaps even a state. They don't. They come against them. So as far as God is concerned, God is waiting one day for a restored people. Until they are restored, there will not be a nation as God calls them. And there are even Jews today in different parts of the world who don't even themselves recognize that Israel is a nation. This is not just with the United Nations. Even their own Jewish people in New York, which is about 3.2 million of them, they don't even recognize that the current present people living there in Israel is a nation. Can you imagine that? So, but the word Hebrew, the difference is this, okay? This is where you find the difference. The word Hebrew is the word that we use for the language. All right? So Jews, they speak a language called Hebrew. Now, language, when God spoke to Moses, God spoke in Hebrew. When God gave the commandments to Moses and the early children of Israel, he spoke in Hebrew. When God called Abraham, God called him a Hebrew. So the word Hebrew denotes that it is the language. And now, how many of you know that language denotes what? What does language mean? Language forms what? Language forms relationships. Language forms culture. Language forms values. Language forms communication. Language forms habits. Language forms so much that is in us as a people. So when God sees the children of Israel today, he calls them Hebrews. Hebrew denotes that God said that you are my people. I communicate with you. You are supposed to communicate with me. You are in the place of relationship with me. So Hebrew denotes a people that is living in covenant relationship. Language. All right? Language. Communication. So this is why when God sees Jews today, he calls them Hebrews. They are my Hebrew children. Abraham was called the first Hebrew in the Bible. So along that line, Eugene was sharing with us and how our faith came from this background. The Bibles that we have in our hands. It's sad that today we have lost that. We have read the Bible for so long until to the point as if that the New Testament is from America. The Old Testament is somewhere from the Sinai desert. All right? And before you know it, the whole identity of Israel, the whole identity of the Hebrew foundation to the faith is lost. Now, what I want to do tonight, and you can safely now, or perhaps go with me to the Psalms, and this is what I want to do, not any specific psalm, but just open to a particular psalm, which is Psalm 130. Just open it, not in particular that we're going to read about it. 130, Psalm 130. Psalm 130. Just have that open. Now, I want to talk to you about this whole psalm, as in not just Psalm 130, but the Psalm of Israel. If there's anything that we need to understand about our faith, is to understand the Psalms. The Psalms that God gave to the children of Israel, to the Hebrew children. All right? Now, it is no accident that it's found in our Bible. So whatever race that we are today, wherever you go in the nations of the world, whatever translation that the Bible has been translated into, you cannot, but you must translate all of the Psalms. And it's the longest. There's 150 Psalms in it. So in terms, we don't call Psalms chapters. We call them Psalms. Psalms means that they are either prayers or they are songs. Okay? That's what they're made up of. Psalm simply means either they are prayer or they are songs. In fact, they are essentially prayers. Before then, they are turned into songs. So if you go to some of these synagogues, synagogue means the Jewish places where the Jews goes to worship today. Now these synagogues are not Messiah or Messianic Jews, in order to make it much easier for you. Not all the synagogues are Messianic in nature, meaning if you go to some of these synagogues, it doesn't mean that they worship. Some of them, they worship Jesus in certain parts of the world. But most of them, they are just Orthodox Jewish believers, meaning they just believe in the Torah, they believe in the Old Testament, they believe in some of the prophets, not all of the prophets, they believe in some of the Pentateuch, the first five books in the Bible, but they do not believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Do they get together to worship? Yes, they worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They read the first five books of the Old Testament, known as the Pentateuch, which of course are the writings of Moses. Moses is their great prophet. Moses is their great teacher. All right? They spent a lot of time reading a lot of that. Now, what happened is, I want you to know this, is that they read the Psalms. So not only the modern Jews of our time in the synagogues of the world read the Psalms, but every Bible translated into any language cannot miss out having to translate all of the Psalms. So I want to talk to you here tonight about the Psalms of Israel. Alright? So what I want to do is to put the two words here. It's the word Hebrew. It's the word Greek here. Right? Now, there are basically two cultures in the world today. You may not know it. The two cultures of the world is either a Hebrew culture or a Greek culture. Now, as I said a while ago, that you may not know it. Now, our world that we live in, Malaysia, Singapore, the big part of Asia, the big part of Europe, the big part of America, the big part of any part of the world today, the very foundation to a lot of the culture in which all of us are living in, it is not Hebrew in nature. All right? They are Greek in nature. Let me give you a good example. Have you ever seen all those huge columns? Huge column that stands up that has a capita on it. You know, sometimes you find them. You go to Singapore, you find some of these huge pillars, these columns built in courthouses. Where else can you find them? Think in Malaysia if you can remember them in your mind. All these huge columns. Now, these columns are found in the nations. Now, if you go to, like I have traveled in a fair bit of it, if you go to America, you find the columns in Washington, D.C. You go to any part of Europe, any country, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal. All right, all of these nations, you'll find all of these huge columns in the buildings. All right, yeah, architect. Where did that come from? It came from Greek. All right, it's a Greek culture. It's a Greek influence. It's Greek architectural designed. But how is it that from Greek, when I was in Rome not too long ago, I saw those pillars. I particularly took pictures of that because I was talking to the pastor, and of course we were talking, but as I was looking around in the whole capital of Rome, in that particular area, all these columns were there for the last, 4,000 years, and some of these columns are still standing. They're all preserved, all right? They are not closed-door museum. They are all in a city. And Rome, everything about Rome is a museum. You don't have to walk into a building. Everything is just in the open. Thousands of people will be there taking pictures. So I saw those columns from afar, and every one of them, those columns, some of them are all half destroyed, half broken down, but the structures stand after thousands of years. And when you see them standing in Rome, you see these same structures in the nations of the world. It's because the world has copied Greek designs. And our parliament, our senator, our congress, our what else? Our government, our politics. The word senator, or we call it senator or senator actually. And all of these words that we use in government and politics, they all come from Greek. The whole world celebrate once in 4 years, the Olympics. The Olympics came from Greek. Sports, discus, running, weightlifting, high jump. Do you know that? They were all Greek sports. These were made popular by the Greek culture. The whole world, literature, philosophy, a lot of the philosophy, all the philosophical thoughts, the way in which people think, the values, money, by the way, all right, currency, all this are from Greek culture. Now the world is run on the whole foundation of Greek culture. All right? So it has seeped into the very fabric of our world. It's just that we don't think about these things. But it's there, and it's very powerful. In fact, if you read your Bible long enough, one day you start to know that a lot of churches today are even influenced by Greek mentality in reading the scriptures. And this is where a big problem is. We'll come to that in one of these days. A lot of approach to the Bible is from Greek approach, Greek mentality, Greek philosophy. And because of that, that has hampered a lot of Christian understanding, Hebrew understanding of who God is. Okay, now that's a little bit further, but I'm just trying to put this before you that the world today is based so much on the whole basis of Greek culture, Greek civilization. Got it? All right. Now, and because this is so predominant and this is so ingrained in the world that we've missed out the Hebraic or the Hebrew culture. Right, and now this is what I want to do. I want to take you to the Psalms. Now it's in Psalms. I want to read you a particular when you start to go to Psalm. Where should I put this? Well, later. I need the board for something else. When you start to go to the Psalm, when you open up Psalm, let me just read 130 for you. Will you do that? If you have this open before you. From the depths of despair, O Lord, I call for your help. Hear my cry, O Lord. Pay attention to my prayer. Lord, if you kept the record of our sins, who, O Lord, could ever survive? But you offer forgiveness that we might learn to fear you. Verse 5. I am counting on the Lord. Yes, I am counting on you. I have put my hope in His Word. I long for the Lord more than sentries long for the dawn. Sentries, of course, is your word, watchman. Yes, more than sentries will long for the dawn. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is unfailing love. His redemption overflows. He Himself will redeem Israel from every kind of sin. Now, I'm just picking one of the psalm here, but in all the years, and you will, my prayer is, my hope is for all of us too, is to keep psalm as your lifetime companion. I know that we need to read other books, but keep psalm very much at the center of your devotion, at the center of your reading. Now, listen, it's very important, because nothing is going to show us how Hebraic, how Hebrew is the psalm. How is it that God has always wanted a people, a nation, and the nations of the world, and the inhabitants of the world to know Him like this? And I'm thankful for the psalm, because the first people who was given the psalms were the Jews. All right. Now, there isn't one single author in all of this 150 psalms that is Gentile. Not one Gentile is responsible for contributing any of the 150 psalms in our Bible. Not one. Half of which is David himself. The other half is by other singers or other psalmists who wrote them, whose names is not even mentioned. They're just called sons of Korah, or sons of Asaph, or sons of this, or sons of that. We don't even know who they are, but they are not. Listen, they are not Gentiles. They are all Hebrews. They were Jewish by origin. Now, very important, because when you start to read the Psalms like the one we just read, what do you find? You find this word here. And this is so important for us to see this. Okay? I'm going to put the word here. All right. All of the Psalms, basically, is to show to us that God has a people on the earth, which, of course, are Hebrews. And God put them on the earth, or chose them while they are on the earth, to do one thing. And that is to respond to who? To respond to God. All right? So what you have in all of the 150 Psalms is this. It is a people that God has called. Now, there are two things that mark out the Jews. When the Jews were called by God, there were two things that live in their consciousness every day. There were two things that Hebrews or Jewish boys or girls that ever grow up must never forget. Two things. Any modern Jew will tell you this, if they are sensitive enough. Two things. Number one is their calling, for C. Second one is the choosing. They were first called. When you open your Old Testament, one of the first things that you notice was God called them. He didn't call the Chinese, He didn't call the Indians, He didn't call the Japanese or the Koreans or the Haitians or whoever they are. He first called a Hebrew. What was the call about? It was to call them one day to become a people, a nation that will enter into the land of promise. Number one. That's why Jews were a people of purpose. And when God called them, it was very simple. Call them, raise them, get them together, and send them into the land of promise. God never called them to become a great army. God never called them to become a great economy. God never called them to form a huge empire. Or build great cities. You know, most these are the histories of the world. The histories of non-Jewish or non-Hebraic histories are the histories of empire. China, China has got full of empire. Ming Dynasty, Wong, oh sorry, not Wong. Ming Dynasty, Qing Dynasty, what else? All kinds of dynasty, isn't it, eh? All kinds of dynasty that went, you know, destroying one another, killing one another, and so on and so forth. But God never called the Hebrew to become a great dynasty or a great, a great empire, to become great conquerors, to become Alexander the Great, and so on, or be Kublai Khan or Genghis Khan. And all of this, God never called them to do any of these things. God called them to be a people, and with one focus, I want you to be faithful, I want you to obey my commandment, and follow me, and I'll take you to the land of promise. How humble can that be? And you spend all your days just doing farming. How many of you know that you don't become famous when you do farming? You don't conquer nations and become a great empire and raise dynasty when you look after your wheat and your barley year after year and depend on God to give you the weather and regulate your rain so that you know all the times and the seasons will be ordered by the Lord. Isn't that wonderful? Israel was to remain faithful to this call. It was at the very soul of your nation. They can never forget that God was to be obeyed, that God was to bring them to a land of promise and begin to know who He is first. Second, first C is called, second C, they were chosen. What were they chosen? They were chosen because God gave them a king. Now, they wanted a king. And God said, you don't need a king. Let me rule you. They didn't want God to rule them. So they complained to Samuel that they wanted the king. God said, well, I'll tell you what. They didn't come against you, Samuel. They came against me. They want a king. I'm going to give them a king. So God said, I'll give you a king. But know this, the day when I give you a king, he said, all your children are going to suffer. Because since you have a king is going to come to you and take your wife, take your children, it's going to take your sons, it's going to take your daughter, it's going to take your land, because that's what kings do. King is going to own you. King is going to take over. King is going to get all your sons to go fight their battles. And because your sons are going to fight your king's battle, your sons are going to die in battle. And when your son dies in battle, then you who are fathers and mothers are going to moan. It's in the Bible. He said, you are going to moan. You are going to have things like that. So since you want a king, why? Because Israel wasn't happy, wasn't satisfied that God was their king. So because they were not satisfied to submit themselves to the kingship of Yahweh, to the kingship of God, so they wanted a human king. So God gave them human kings. And God warned them, if you have human kings, this is what's going to happen to you. And yet they want it. So God said to Samuel, he said, they didn't come against you, they came against me. They didn't break your heart, they broke my heart. All right, let them have it. So they had human kings. And of course, we all know what happened. Saul failed. But you see, God in his wisdom was looking forward to the future. Because God all the time has always wanted to be their king. And since this has failed in Saul, so God said, let me appoint my own king for you. And I will use my king on earth to express my heart, my rule, and my demands on you. I will use this king on earth to establish a throne that will become the representation of my kingship. And who was that, by the way? David. So God gave Israel a king called David. And upon King David's throne will be, listen, will be all of the everlasting kingdom of God. In other words, God said, when you look into the life of David and his kingship, God said, you're going to see facets. You're going to see shades of all of how I'm going to rule you. David is going to represent my kingdom, my government on earth. That's why when you read David, he is a king like no other king. Yes or no? He's a king like no other king. He doesn't even live like a king. All right? He doesn't even come like the kings of the world. He is so different from every other king. In fact, ever since David, God has always used David and his kingdom, or as his throne, to be the what do you call that? The reference point. And God has got a way of speaking like this in the Old Testament, and so was a king, but you know what? He was not like David. So and so was a king, but he was not like David. So and so and so was a good king, but he was not like my servant David. So David became the reference point. David became the standard of God's government on earth. You got the point there? So Israel, in all of the years of growing up, understood that they need to look and pay attention to this choosing, the choosing of King David. Because the choosing of King David was to send a message to all of the Hebrew children that what? You are to be submitted to my kingship. David is going to remind them of God's kingship. Not men, God. So is it accidental to find out that in Psalms, half of the Psalms, who was responsible for them? David. And why did David pen so many of these Psalms? Is because David understood that his kingship or his kingdom, or that he is a king, not because that he was a king to do his own thing. You know, king always do their own things, isn't it? If you are a king, you have the right to do anything you want. He's the only king who can't do what he wants. It's to remind Israel that you're not supposed to do what you want. So David was a constant reminder to the children of Israel of the kingship of God himself. He was just a representation here on earth. He's not the final authority. So you don't ever see David going around flexing his muscles, doing all he wants. Now, he did some of the wrongs. He took someone's wife. He was responsible for the death of even this woman that he took. And virtually rape her, but in the end there were consequences. But that only happened once. And never happened again. He would never ever take that road ever again, because he knew the heart of God. He knew that this was not God's heart. He knew that he misrepresented the kingship of God. That's why some of you don't understand why God was so severe with Israel, with David. He woke up one day, he said, "You know what? I just wanted to count how many soldiers I have in my army." What's wrong with being a king who wants to count how many soldiers you have? What's wrong with that? You tell me one king who doesn't want to know how big is his army. Is that illegal? No. The scripture is very clear. One day he woke up and he asked his general, "How big is my army? Go down there and have a count." And the general had the sense to tell him, "Sire, you want to do that? You really want to do that? Go count. How big is our army?" The moment he counted, he came back. Now, the scriptures say that Satan provoked him. There was a provocation from another realm that got David stir up to count his army, to count the heads of his army. Now, even his general knew that all of the success and all of the battles that they won was not because of the army. Was because of God. So suddenly when David turns his attention to count heads in his army, he tells what? He tells even the general, he said, "Your Majesty, sire, you don't have to count the heads of the army, the heads of soldiers in your army, because you know it's not how big is your army that gives you the victory. It's God that gives you the victory. So for you to count it is as good as what? As you are actually rebelling against God. You're telling God that it is by your own strength that you can get your victory." And the moment he did that, the judgment that fell on David. 70,000 men were slain just in days. And he knew he was wrong. He pleaded. He pleaded and said, "It's my sin that I have done this." So understand why the severity. Some of us, you know, sometimes we read the Old Testament, we don't even know why God was so severe with David. Was because it's what he represented. And if David fails like that and do not represent God correctly, then what hope will Israel have as a people? If you wrongly present me to the nation of Israel, then what will Israel think of me? If you are to represent me and you will act like that and you will behave like that, then what will all of the children of Israel think of me? So God held him accountable. You're not supposed to be like that. So the children of Israel grew up, all of the generations, one after another, with this two understanding. These were the two foundational pillars, all right, that regulated everything in the Jewish mind, in the Jewish psyche. It was in them. It's first their call, second the choosing. The call of going into the land of promise, and the choosing, of course, of the very kingship of God over their lives. So listen, very important. So right at the very onset, every Jew, every Hebrew kid, every Hebrew boy, and every Hebrew girl understood this. And this is how wonderful Hebraic culture is, Hebraic understanding is. And what is Hebraic understanding? What is Hebrew understanding is this. The Hebrews were taught to do this. They were taught to respond to God. You know, it's strange that in the Greek culture is always, Adro teaches philosophy. He will probably help me whether it's true or not. Greek culture is always wanting to find out, you know, more about men. Isn't it? How men exist in this world. Human spirit. You know, human understanding. Isn't it? It's always having to explore, having to go out. What is man? You know? How great is man? How talented is man? What is man's place in this great universe? See that or not? So you notice the arrow is always having to go out there and find out, oh, why? Why man has to suffer? Why man has to be like this? Why man has to die? Why man has disease? Why man has this? You know, it's always this big question. That's why we call it Greek philosophy. And the foundation of Greek philosophy is to seek understanding, human existence. What what does it mean to be a man? Isn't it, eh? That's why all the Greek sculptures, you know, all those sculptures, all those human muscles, you go to some of these European countries, all these huge statues, all these are all human figure. All right? Men with protruding muscles, lean muscles, all naked bodies. All this came from Greek culture, discovering your physique, you know. What do you have? What do you have? Admire yourself, look at yourself. Beauty. Greek. But the Hebrews were not supposed to seek for human understanding what is happening to human affairs, human existence. You know, that's not the duty of the Hebrews. The Hebrews is to do this. It is to respond and find out what God is after. So there's only one arrow here with the Hebrews, and their arrow is to do this. Is to what? Is to respond to what God is doing. God never asked the Hebrew children to find out where is their place in the universe. God never asked the Hebrew children to find out and define what is human existence. What does it mean to be a human, to be a man, to be a woman? Where's my place in this universe? This is not in the Hebrew. This is not in the Psalms. That's why all of the 150 Psalms has this one foundation. And the foundation is what? Why was Psalms written? It was written because it was a people that was taught how to what? Read this. Respond to who? To God. They are to respond to God, to what God is saying, to respond to what God is doing. Because in responding to God, listen, because in responding to God, come on, what happens? I'm just off my head, I'm just talking like that. In responding to God, what happens? You start to find out who you are. You start to find out your identity. Yes or no? You start to define out where your place is before God. And once your identity, listen, once you know your identity, then what? Then you are secure. Then you find your worth. Then you find your value. And then you find your meaning. Then you find your purpose. Yes or no? There you are. And then you can go on. You can find all of this. The moment when your identity is established, this is where it all follows. Your values, your purpose. As a man, as a woman, begins to come to you. So, the Hebrews were taught how to respond to God. So it's interesting that Eugene Peterson wrote this. I'll just small of the quote. He's a scholar, so he puts it perhaps better. The Hebrews were not so much interested in understanding the human condition as they were in responding to divine reality. All right? They're not supposed to find out things about themselves, our human conditions, why this, why that, and why the other. And this is very Greek-based, very Greek foundation. And look at what's happening today. Every society that you go to today, all this consciousness about yourself, having to discover who you are, why you're like this. And that's why the more we start to discover ourselves, the more messed up we are. You start to discover that, you know what? I'm male. My whole body has got male features, but I don't know why I've got this liking to be a female. You understand what I'm saying? And this is where we've been talking as a family, this whole thing on the gender war, the transgender thing. It's starting to be crazy. The war is no longer defined by male or female anymore. Male, female, and etc., etc. I sometimes park my car in the traffic light. I look across outside my window. I tell my wife, is that a man or a woman? Can't even tell the driver whether it's a man or a woman. Yeah, exactly. Now it's unisex. So what happened is that this is what I'm talking about. They were never meant. And that's why you need to understand. The church needs to understand. And the tragic thing is that today, what if I say to you, the church is not even Hebraic orientated today. The church is moving so much towards a very Greek orientation of the way we read the Bible, the way we practice church, the way we do things, the values that we have in our lives today, they are so Greek orientated. The Hebrews were not interested in the understanding of human conditions. All right? That's why all of the 150 Psalms were written by men and women that was responding to God. They were not responding to their own human conditions, but responding to the very reality of who God is. So their purpose, the Hebrew purpose, was not to understand what was going on in the human race. All right? They were not called to understand what's happening to the human race. This is what I said, that as God called the children of Israel, these were the two structure, the two basic foundations. When God called them, this, the first call, this is the call, this is the choosing. Both was related to what? To what God wanted. God never called them to look at themselves, what they can become, what they can be. how they can develop their own race to become a great army, to be great conquerors and fighters and captors and go out there, you know, and be this and be the other. No, God never called them that. God called them with the purpose of having to serve Him. So this is when the writer here says, they are not to understand what's going on in the human race, but to be a part of what God was doing. Got the point? They were to become a part. So they were brought into what? Simple English word. They were brought into partnership. All right? So the Hebraic culture was that they were a people that were brought to a partnership with God. So becoming a partner with God between a Hebrew and God. Listen, partner is wonderful. Partnership is wonderful. But this is the thing that Jews have to understand. And Hebrew boys and girls have to understand all their lives. Partner means we're not equal. You know, sometimes when we do business and when we do partnership, hey, equal, 50-50. Back there, there's no 50-50. It's all God and none of you. The partnership and the dialogue between a Hebrew, between a Moses and God, was this. It's a partnership between Joshua and God, between Samuel and God, and all through the Old Testament that you read, God has a partnership with Israel, but it's not equal partnership. Which means, I partner with you, but in that partnership, you learn who I am. You know that I am God. And you will learn what it means to heed my voice. You will learn what it means to submit to my will. You'll learn what it means to know humility. You'll know what it means to obey me. You know what it means to follow my commandments. You understand what I'm saying here? And as Israel get engaged in this great covenant, in this great partnership, Israel's responsibility, a responsibility of these Hebrews, was to keep responding to God. Now, how many of you know that it is safe to respond to God? God wants Israel to respond to Him, to make discovery and to come into knowledge what God is after, what God is doing, what God's plan is, what God's interest is. Are you listening here? And as Israel began to discover in the partnership more and more what God wanted, what God desired, it's strange, isn't it? There's a dynamics like that. The moment when Israel began to understand more of what God wanted, listen, their needs got met. As they respond more to what God is doing, they become more valuable, more worthy. They came into greater identity. I don't know what were these words that I chose, but they came into an identity. The more they understood God's way, they begin to discover their values. The more they knew God, the more they knew themselves. The more they walked with God, the more they understood their place in history, their place in the world. They became more fulfilled. They became more secure. Are you here? But see, the Greek culture runs the other way. Know more of yourself. The more you know yourself, the more confident you are. Learn more. Go to the university. Have 5 PhD. Then you will know yourself. Then why is it they're all ending up in mental asylum? Not all of them. Why are they shooting themselves? Why are they killing themselves? The man that took the gun in Colorado in the theater and shot 20, 30 people, he was a master's degree. He had a master's in university. But he had a gun and went in and killed 20, 30 people in just half an hour. This is why reading the Psalms brings to us an understanding and a whole concept of what it means to respond. And let me put this in perspective just before I close. And this word here, respond, is one of the most Hebraic and one of the most wonderful relational word that God has given to us in the Psalms. I'm now wondering, if these Jews did not respond to God, we won't be reading all the 150 Psalms. So every time when you open the Psalms of Israel, what are you reading? What are you engaging? What are you becoming a part of after almost 4,000 years now? That's exactly where we are. 2018 now, this is how far we are from all of the 150 Psalms, almost close to 4,000 years, 3,000 years of history. What does that have to do with me? But it's strange. Have you ever read Psalms? Why is it that the Psalm here, all 150 Psalms, are so enduring? Because it speaks to us in our humanity. If God is real in our lives as Christians, it begins to remind us that we are in the same journey with the children of Israel. We are to learn what it means to respond to God. And because of what sin have done to all of us today, we're very poor responders. And the way in which we respond to God is going to determine where our relationship with is. Even in human relationships, you know, you talk about that, isn't it? You have got 5 children. I go and visit your house, and before you know it, I just know out of the 5, there's one that is very different from the other 4. And I hear fathers or mothers telling me that, yeah, this one is different because this one is don't respond very well. And you can tell. Don't respond very well. All the commandments, all the instructions I tell him, he won't do one. You know, and he doesn't pay attention to what I say. He doesn't care. And you can tell, out of the 5 children sitting in the house, you know that all the other 4 is so different from this one. Because the one who don't respond well, in the end, starts to show in their life. They don't respond well to instructions, to commandments, you know, to discipline. Something happens. That's in the natural family. Isn't it? Just in a natural family. Some of you brothers who are sitting here will understand what I'm saying. You didn't respond well. Some of us here, we didn't respond well to our fathers, to our parents. I'm not saying that all our parents were perfect. But you can tell, even in a natural family, when a child is not responding, how much more here when God began to raise this family and taught the Hebrews, an entire generation, one after another, to teach them how to respond to God. And so reading the Psalms of Israel help us as Christian to respond. And that's why you need to read the Psalms. Responding becomes a journey in our lives to find out how is it that we need to know to give to God. How do we make responses? Why? Listen, because as a human, as a fallen man, as a fallen human means that we are sinful. It means that when we were born with sin in our bloodstream. We can't help it. There's no such thing in a hospital where you can de-sin a child. You can ask Eunice if that can happen. We can all line up tomorrow in the hospital to do de-sinning. I know they have, what do we call this? Detox, isn't it? Yeah. They can detox, but they don't de-sin. So I don't know what is detox, but they can't de-sin, you know. I wish there was something. If I can have, you know, 8 pints of blood, you know, from somewhere, that then when I'm all done, all the 8 pints get into my blood, all my old blood is removed or gone, I'm now free from sin. That'll be nice. We don't have to go back to GP. We don't have to go to Gethsemane. We don't have to go to Calvary. We don't have to go to Golgotha. We don't have to go to any center. We just have to lie down at 8 pints of the sinning blood. Gao ding. Tomorrow we're free. We won't lose our temper. We won't have desire for anything. We won't sniff glue. We don't push needles in our veins no more. We're done. We don't go out there and send our guts out because we're decent. No, it can't. Doesn't happen that way. And because in our fallen state, God, through the love of Jesus, through the salvation of Jesus Christ, has entered into our life. And from that point on, for the last 44, coming to 44 years of my walk with the Lord, I'm learning more and more year after year, day after day, week after week, month after month, to learn how to respond to God. The better I am in my responding to God, the better it is I grasp what God is doing. I'm not supposed to sit down in my chair and start to dig on the inside what is wrong with me. You know, we like to do that. It's called digmanship. It's not workmanship, it's called digmanship. So we start digging. Okay? So we call this what you call it, self-therapy. Right? We call it the, what do you call it, belly button watching. You know, your belly button watching. Keep having a watch. Why like that one? Thomas, why like? I also don't know why. So it's all his belly button watching. So having to look inside all the time. Why am I no good? Why I fail? I thought I should not go take the cigarette. I went and took the cigarette, and so on and so forth. You know, Harry, just before Harry died, Harry told me a joke about someone from GP. I don't know who I know the person, but you may not know. So it seems that he sent the guy there to do some chores in OUG. He's supposed to buy something with the motorbike. He went out. He didn't come back. I mean, the thing was just less than half an hour. He didn't come back for three, four hours. So Harry told me, he said, I have to go out to look for the guy. I said, how do you look for him? I know where he is. So I said, what do you think he is? I tell you where he went. So he was sitting in a cinema. So Harry got to know the cinema guy who used, those days they used torchlight, you know. The old cinema, not the modern one. So Harry know this guy, he said, can you go inside? I want to have a look and see. So the guy went inside, the show was really going on. So Harry with that guy, with a torch, went looking. And Harry somehow knew where he was sitting. So he told the guy, point your torch there. And he was sitting there. And the light came on him. And Harry saw, wee! What happened, brother? I asked you to buy the thing. How long already? Why do you come inside here? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? You mean you went inside the cinema, you don't know? You sit down there for the last 2-3 hours, you didn't come back with the thing I'm supposed to buy? You didn't know. Of course you know. So Harry was kind of telling me, you know, how hard it is. And these are mistakes they do again and again and again. Helping them to understand that it's not just about the program. It's not about a brother or a staff member or a Jeff or a Cornelius or anyone for that matter. You need to respond to the Lord. So listen. So all of the years of our growing up, however long you are, I'm 44 in my walk with the Lord, but every day I need to make responses to the Lord. And those responses are very important. These responses are going to determine where you're going to be. Now watch, this entire book is on your lap today. It has some very, very tragic story. This is not just a tragic story with one man. It's a tragic story with an entire nation. Why? Because we can make wrong responses. We can give to God responses that is not good, that is failing, that is not healthy, that is not turning us to God. See, that's why one of the wonderful things about the word presence. You know, you always hear the word the presence of the Lord. God, we pray that your presence will come. Do you know in Hebrew, the word presence is not like the way we understand English? Presence is always like, you know, you feel something. In the Hebrew theology, in the Hebrew culture, the presence is the word called panim. And panim means it's the face. You don't feel, when I was growing up, I don't feel my father's presence. I look at my father's face. When my father is talking to me, I don't turn and say, go on talking, I can feel your presence. That's it all. If I ever do that to my father, that's the end of me. When he talks, I don't say, keep on talking, I can feel your presence. And then you're walking away. If your father talked to you, which is an earthly father, what do? You turn. You turn to the voice that's coming towards you, and you face him. So the Hebrew understanding is that they face God. The presence of the Lord means they face God. And how do they face God? Because God doesn't have face like we do with eyes and ears. The face of God is his word. You face my word. When I say to you, you are rebellious, you face me. You face me with your rebellion. When you read the Psalms, you find men telling God, God, I am angry. God, I have been betrayed. God, these enemies are attacking me for nothing. Why are you allowing them to do that? And then God will look at the children of Israel or whoever the psalmist is, and God will say, he said, for my hands will be upon you, for I will lead you here. I will let you do this. I'll let you pass through it that you might know my ways. Can you imagine God's talking like that? Responding, speaking to this person who is praying. That's why these psalms are prayer. And as they pray, they begin to understand that God is speaking to them to the word. So they face God. Okay, God, I don't understand. How long, Lord? How long? Okay, God, if this is what you want, but how long? How long, Lord? One of the cries of the psalmist, how long? God, how long? I know this is what you want for me, but how long? And then you know what? God is silent. At least he's here 6 months. And then at least I can bite my tongue. I'll pass through it 6 months. And God is silent. And why is God silent? Because he's God. He doesn't want you to know how long you're going to suffer. He won't let you know. He won't. He'll just keep silent. He'll just let you be there. How long, God? How long does this have to go on? And all through the Psalms, these were men and women that were learning to pray to God. Alright, this is the partnership. They pray, they sung, they cry, they anguish, they labored, they travail, they were in pain, and they were in affliction, and they were in persecution. All of the human emotions, as I call them, the spectrum of all of human emotions are found in the Psalms. If you can put A to Z, if there's a thing called A to Z of human emotions, they're all found in all of the 150 Psalms. And you find God having to see men pass through the A to Z of human emotions. And what does Hebrew and Hebrew children must do and learn as a people is to bring them before God. And as they bring them before God, they begin to discover, they begin to understand what God is after in the situation, in their pain, in their sorrows, in their abandonment, in their conquest, or in their attack, or in the assault by the enemy and by their adversaries, or while they're being misunderstood, or they're being attacked, or they're being abused. Because Hebrews were the poorer people in the nations wherever they went. So they were always orphans, the oppressed, the destitute. They were always poor people. They were agricultural people. And once you are an agricultural people, the chances are you'll be poor in comparison to the world. Are you listening? What's happening to the world today? We're starting to abandon our agriculture. That's why the latest study is by the year 2040, the world will be in famine. That's why so much of the food we are buying is GMO, because they have to quickly multiply and bring food into the market. Because why? If you can't, because we can't cope with the production because of global warming, because of the, come on guys, when was the last time PJ got so cold in the last 2-3 weeks? Huh? It starts to snow in OUG, let me know. Huh? Some of you here, you're putting jackets already, you know, because the weather changed. I went to Sri Lanka. One of the first things when the new president came into power in Sri Lanka was this. Sri Lanka was one of the top producers of garlic in the world. Today, Sri Lanka is importing garlic from India. And he stood up in his speech, and in the first week of his presidential office, and this is what he said to the nation. He himself, 40 years ago, was a farmer. He said, "I want to bring back farming to Sri Lanka. I want Sri Lanka to plant garlic again. We don't have to import garlic. You know how expensive garlic is now?" He said, "Why are we buying garlic from India?" It's because they don't want to plant garlic anymore. The world is drying up, is withering. Our ecosystem is falling apart. And that's why everyone is into fast food. It's processed food in the nations. Because there's nothing to gain from agriculture. Everybody wants the city life, the technology. They want the skyscrapers, they want the machines, they want the computers. So they were a poor people. So wherever they went, they were always in dependency. They depended on God for provision. So God will give them the weather, control the weather, or sustain the weather for them so that their wheats and their barleys will grow properly, so that they can be fed. They were a people that knew and learned to respond. What is our faith? What is the very foundation of our faith? Respond. And we have to move from a Greek culture. God has to take us away from so much that is so Hellenistic. The word Greek is the word Hellenistic. We're so Hellenistic in our approaches. Every time when something is not good, it's not right, we quickly figure out in our heads what to do, isn't it? First thing to do, oh, what did I do wrong? How should I do it better? Oh, I'm going to call all of my resources in my head and figure out exactly how do I do it. That's it. That's the first thing. When something happens to you, the first thing, when your body is not comfortable, what's the first thing? Is it prayer? Is it going to the Lord? Lord, what are you saying? God, I'm not well. Lord, I'm this, I'm that. God, I'm seeking you. There's something in my family. God, I'm seeking you. Lord, what are you saying? God, I'm coming to you. See, it's never God for many of us. The first thing, I'm going to call Thomas. Thomas, what the fuck? First person is always Jeff. First person is a Thomas. Or first person is a Cornelius. The first person is this and the other. It's a doctor, it's a psychologist, it's a dentist, you know, it's a counselor, it's a therapist. We're always that, isn't it? Eh? Yeah. First thing, there's always someone that we need to go to when something don't work. The car, the tire's not working, we know exactly where to go. Because the whole system of the world is built on this whole power of self-realization, of our own effort, our own ability, our own management. Our first response in life is always, how I can do better. I, me and myself. How I can improve. How I can be better. How I will not let this happen and that happen. It is never the first thing to come, God, what are you saying? God, this is the third time. This is 3 times in the whole month I've been banging on people's car. God, what are you saying? Lord, 4 times already I'm falling down. Every time I take the stairs, I plop, 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 plop.
Then you go and then you go and check your slippers. Put it under the x-ray. It's not the slippers. It's God getting your attention. See, we don't approach life like this. We don't respond to God as we should. So to the point, more and more, and you wonder why so many of us are sitting in churches today where our responses is virtually, cut away. A kind of a partnership when one party don't respond to the other. At some point the partnership will not work. Perhaps this is the picture of so many men and women today at the time of their most critical moment. They cry out to God and they wonder why God didn't respond to them. Because there's never been a habit, there's never been a pattern, there's never been a basis of learning to respond to the Lord. Reading the Psalms is to enable us and to teach us and give us the skill to respond. Why read the Psalms? So that you can develop your skills, so that you can be reminded how to respond. Some of you here say, I don't know how to pray. Read the Psalms. He said that, oh, I don't know how to read the Psalms. Then sing the Psalm. Open the Psalms 23 and sing and compose your own tune. A demo song, demo tune. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Dang. Compose. You don't know how to read that out? Sing it. Sing your Psalm. One wonderful thing about Jews is that they sing their prayers. You know that? The prayers are in the form of songs. They sing. Even the Orthodox Jews today. So it's a wonderful thing when you hear them. You think they're actually singing a song. They are. They're not singing a song as per se. We know them to be songs. They're actually singing their prayers. Sing. Sing the psalm. Your own one. You don't have to copy it from, Hosanna praise, whatever. Sing yours. Sing Psalms 130 on your own. I sing them sometimes in my own times. I sing the psalm to myself. When I remember those psalms that cross my mind, I sing them before the Lord. It's my prayer. I'm learning. I'm wanting to learn how to respond. And every time when you start to respond, every part of your being begins to open up. That's why your emotions, your feelings, your imaginations, your thinking, your intellect, your reasoning, every part begins to come alive with respond. You train all those avenues and those faculties in you to respond. And that's why you know how to respond. And when you can respond, and when you do respond, then you're opening yourself to what? To allow the Lord to come in and engage you with Himself and show to you what He is after, what He is doing, what He is saying, what His will is, what His mind is. You begin to understand, oh God, now I know. Now I know why you delayed for almost 2 years over this issue. Lord, I'm so thankful you delayed it. I didn't know it at that time, but now I do. You see, you're engaged. 2 years later, the Lord began to give you understanding why He didn't answer you in those 2 years when you're going through, you know, with your mother or your father or your brother or your colleague in the company. Now you begin to understand. Oh, Lord, I didn't know that, but now I know. You see, you're engaging. You're in the place of responding to the Lord. May we do so. So Lord, help us here as brothers and sisters, as men and women in the church, because it was as you intended even for Israel, for every Hebrew children. May we learn how to respond to you. Help us, teach us. Teach us to open to the Psalms and read them, Lord, in whatever ways that we are, whatever level of understanding that we may have. It don't matter as long as you are our partner. As long as you have loved us and have called us unto yourself. You chose us. Yeah, you chose us at the very foundation of the world. So Lord, you have not forgotten that. You are faithful to your own covenant. You are faithful to your own promises. Thank you so much for reminding us in this great economy of such grace. You gave it first to the children of Israel, to these Hebrews. Now we Gentiles are included. Thank you that we have the privilege of reading all of these Psalms and learn from them. And in learning from them, we enter into the same partnership as they did with you, and now you with us, that we might grow and begin to understand, Lord, what is it that you want? What is it that you are desiring? What is it that you call us and save us for? So, Lord, may we come to you. May our hearts respond to you tonight. Thank you again. Set this word in all of our hearts. Bring us there. Teach us, Lord, to respond, even in the most simplest and the minutest of things in our lives, from the kitchen to our bedrooms. Cause us to respond to you. So that, Lord, our first reaction to anything will not be turned just towards men, but first towards you. So that we don't have to call a Jean, a James, a John, a Harry, a brother or a sister. But the first person, Lord, is indeed you. We come to you, we make responses, or we bring our responses to you first, before any other man or any other woman. Thank you so much. So, Lord, come, rest this in our hearts. Assure us how wonderful you are. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the same God over us here today. For this we give you thanks and praise in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Amen.